Good morning and welcome to Up and to the Right, presented by SWMG. My name is Russell Harris, Associate Financial Advisor here at Signature Wealth Management Group, and your host for this podcast. Joining me today are my fellow colleagues, Mr. Ian Payne and Brian Ransom. And today we're gathered for a somewhat somber podcast, to be honest with you. Today we thought, in honor of September 11th, that we would take a look back and discuss some of the impacts that 9/11 has had on our economy and how it's, you know, what its role has been shaping the year since. So with that, let's roll the tape.
Welcome to Up and to the Right, presented by SWMG, a podcast where employees and guests of Signature Wealth Management Group talk about what's new in financial news, financial planning topics that affect the everyday investor, and other relevant topics influencing the markets today.
All right, gents. Hey, thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Excited to have another podcast going. Interesting topic today we thought we'd go over. It's been 22 years now since the tragic events of September 11th. And I don't know about you guys, but I honestly remember a lot of it like it was yesterday. I was in high school, and I remember someone running to the classroom saying, hey, a plane just hit the World Tower, one of the World Trade Center towers, and we just happened to have one of those rolling. I don't know if you guys remember. It was still the box TV. I remember it on the rolling piece with the VCR underneath. And
Ian has no idea what we're talking about.
Oh, actually, yes, I do. Those stayed in schools for a long time.
If they
rolled the TV, it was going to be a good class.
It builds character, I think. Builds character. Yeah. But just happened to have that in that class that day. I don't know why, and was able to get the TV on. And then went to my next class, and the TV was on that one as well. And we saw the second plane hit. And then the announcement that the Pentagon got hit came over. And I think I shared with you guys yesterday, that was a nerve-wracking moment for me because my dad was still in the Army and was actually on a business trip to D.C. And typically when he'd go to D.C., especially in my high school mind, he went to the Pentagon, which he often did. So I was in a sudden panic and concern that maybe my dad was in the Pentagon and got hit in some way. We got the fortunate news, for us at least, that he was not at the Pentagon at the time. He was at a different base in D.C., so he was safe. But what a tragedy.
Yeah.
I remember forever.
Yeah.
You probably remember where you were, Brian.
Yeah. Similar story. I was sophomore in high school. And it went down pretty much, you know, exactly how they showed on the media.
Yeah.
You know, on CNN, you know, you just kind of sitting there watching the TV. They got rolled out. And, you know, to be honest, I don't remember anything else about that day other than just kind of, you know, what happened, and just kind of digesting it, you know. I did grow up in Manhattan, Kansas, which is a stone's throw away from Fort Riley, one of the largest U.S. Army bases in the country. And so having that proximity to Fort Riley, you know, a lot of your classmates are just dialed into that you know, a military background.
Sure.
And so many of my classmates, you know, it seemed like pretty much that day were just ready to sign up.
Yeah.
And thankfully all of them came back.
Yeah. Oh, it's definitely true. And you know, when I was reflecting on it yesterday, as I do every year when it comes around, that's one of the things that I think is important to focus on as well. It's very easy to focus on the tragedy that happened that day and not to make light of the lives that were lost. But at the same time, I think what's important for us, and this is, I'm getting kind of sentimental here as a patriotic American, but I think it's also important to remember what we did that day as a country. I mean, I remember live on television playing out in front of the entire world, to me, what America is all about, the best of America. You saw people with no regard for race, religion, creed, you name it. It didn't matter, right? We were all Americans, and you saw people stepping up to help complete strangers.
Mm-hmm.
Knew nothing about them, never met them before. And the stories you see afterwards of, you know, hi, I'm so-and-so, I'm so-and-so, all right, we're going to get out of here together. To me, that's what it's all about, right? Yep. And I think it's important for us to remember that, because it's very easy to forget and this is just my own personal opinion, but the 99% that makes us all one together. And there's that small little 1% that, sure, we have disagreements like anyone would, right? But to me, it's almost like a family. Hey, we can bicker among ourselves all we want, but don't mess with us as a family. And I think we kind of proved that to the world that day. So
Yeah, it's so interesting. You know, Manhattan, Kansas is completely different culturally, economically, and size from its sister city, Manhattan, New York.
Yeah.
You know, everyone was heartbroken that day, and we all just kind of, you know, American flags were flying in every single household, and it was a great thing to see that portion of the patriotic bounce back, I guess is what you would call it.
Yeah. Yeah, it really was. And we're going to talk a little bit about that today from an economic standpoint, kind of what happened and the impacts it's had long term. So, yeah, definitely a somber day. I think 9/11 is definitely a day, you know, obviously it will forever be in the history books. But I kind of liken it, at least for my generation, similar to events that other generations have faced, like Pearl Harbor or the assassination of Kennedy, right? I think it's one of those things that, you know, my grandkids will ask me, where were you on that day kind of thing? What do you remember?
Mm-hmm.
And it will have its own impact in our society and our culture forever. Even when everyone that witnessed it is long gone, it'll still be there. So, and I think it's important to keep that alive for us to remember that. So
now, Ian, you're a little bit younger than us.
Yep.
Do you want to share your experiences?
I was only a little over a year old in 2001 when this happened. My mom was pushing me in a baby stroller in the local park in North Carolina when my dad called her and told her what had happened. And for me, most of my experience with 9/11 is seeing the videos from it, you know, the news coverage and all that on social media now, but also kind of, Russell, like you were saying, the patriotic nature of, you know, the famous clip is George Bush throwing out the first pitch at Fenway.
Yeah.
Or not at Fenway, at Yankee Stadium afterwards.
Yep.
And that's kind of the one that resonates with me, you know, when I see that and kind of understanding the impact and how, you know, mm-hmm. rival sports teams can be brought together and different, you know, backgrounds. And kind of like you were saying, Russell, you know, that's something that we miss a lot today that I think is unfortunately, that had to be the case at all, but it is a cool sight to see the unity that a tragedy can bring, and kind of bringing everyone together and for a common cause. But for me and, you know, my generation, we remember a lot more of like the Boston bombing. Kind of our generation's, 9/11. Also remember, you know, when Bin Laden was killed.
Yeah,
I do remember that. But 9/11 itself, I was a little young to remember that. So most of my consumption of what had happened that day and understanding of it has come from social media clips and other people's stories like y'all. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did y'all catch the Jets game yesterday?
I did not.
On Monday, 9/11.
I did. Yeah.
It was really a beautiful sight when Aaron Rodgers ran off onto the field with the American flag. They turned all the lights off at the stadium, and he just runs out, and you know, this is New York, right?
Yeah.
This is mm-hmm. MetLife Stadium, and it was very beautiful, and it was tragically for Aaron Rodgers cut short like a play later, but yeah. It was a nice little image that they did.
It was. They did a good job with kind of with that.
Yeah, the tributes are always I like watching those personally. I think it's important to remember, and you know, it was always mixed emotions, as you mentioned. Of course, personally, it shaped my life too with the military and what we did after that. So,
mm-hmm.
But yeah, very interesting day. So, folks, let us know where you were. We'd love to hear your story. So, please feel free to write into the show. Tell us your thoughts, things of that nature. But so, since we're talking about 9/11, we thought, being a financial podcast here, that we would focus a little bit today and discuss kind of looking back on the economic impacts, you know, what happened that day, what's kind of happened since. I think a lot of these different events shape both the short term and the long term economically in many ways, especially when something like the World Trade Center was hit. And so today we just want to kind of discuss a look back on what happened that day. So, I know we have a lot of data here, but I think the first thing that I wanted to just mention that was interesting that I really didn't think about because I was in high school at the time like you, Brian, was that the markets actually never got a chance to open
mm-hmm.
that day.
Yeah. To be honest, I had to look a lot of this stuff up because I was not paying attention to this stuff back then. You know? Too busy, you know, chasing girls or something. I don't know. Back in high school. So yeah, the market closed on September 10th. The Twin Towers got hit around, I believe it was around 8:30 that morning. So the market's open at 9:30. So the market's never got a chance to open. So they just remain closed for the next 7 days, open on September 17th. And then the market promptly fell 4.9% throughout the day. Pretty nasty little loss. Now, we were in the middle of the dot-com bubble, right? So we were already in the throes of a recession.
Yeah, I mean, the market was already pretty down that year, right?
Yeah. I don't have the S&P statistics in front of me, but the NASDAQ was already down 28. I do have the market. The market was down 28% prior to 9/11. And the NASDAQ 100 was down 70%. So that is a nasty little market pullback.
Yeah. Certainly September 11th didn't help, I'm sure, when it comes to market standpoint.
Right.
I think, you know, and obviously, luckily, we're, I would argue, we've bounced back quite a bit from that moment, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you just look back in history where, for example, the S&P 500 is today compared to where it was even throughout that year. But the other thing that I think, and many of us probably know and some may not know, is how much really was at the World Trade Center. And I had a hard time wrapping my head around this. And I've been to New York. I've walked Wall Street. I've been to meetings in the big skyscrapers before. And it's, again, still hard for me to wrap my head around how much business, how much trade is managed and controlled out of Manhattan, out of that area. Yeah. And the World Trade Center itself was massively impactful to not just the U.S. economy, but across the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize that. And we've got some stories here that we've, you know, brought up. But I'll start with a little bit of statistics. I mean, that according to what I was able to find, you know, about the World Trade Center at the time, there are 430 different businesses from 28 different countries that were
in all seven of those buildings
in the World Trade Center. Yeah. So just to clarify, for those that don't know, right, we all know the two main towers there, one and two, but there's actually seven total buildings of the World Trade Center at the time. Now there's five that have been built or rebuilt, however you want to frame that. So in those seven buildings across about 430 businesses from 28 different countries. And I just added this because I thought it was kind of neat. There was a restaurant called Windows of the World, which had some subsidiaries around, but they employed 450 people who spoke more than 60 different languages. And that restaurant, mm-hmm. the main restaurant, was located, unfortunately for them, at the top of the North Tower, which was the first one hit there. Wow. I mean, right there alone, what a melting pot.
Yeah, a lot of skills right there, even in the restaurant industry, they were lost.
Oh, yeah. They were feeding. I think I was watching one of the little documentaries not too long ago, and there was a chef who worked at one of the restaurants there and said that any one time they would feed up to 150,000 people.
Good grief.
I mean, could you imagine that? I mean, I think there was between like 40 and 50,000 people total that worked in the trade center.
Uh-huh.
And like three times that could visit at any one time,
mm-hmm.
like in a day.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and we're talking an area that's, I think it's 16 acres maybe, which is still a lot of land, don't get me wrong, but 16 acres to have 150, 200,000 people?
Right.
I mean, that's just,
it's
for this old Southern boy, that's hard to fathom.
It's interesting to think about, you know, how different business was conducted back then too, right?
Sure.
You know, if you have a meeting with someone, you couldn't just hop on Zoom, right? You had to, you know, walk over to their office and then go meet with someone or pick up the phone call and call them, I suppose. But
on a lot of landlines, too. Not
a lot of landlines, right? So, you know, the density of business done was a necessity at the time because, you know, that was the only way business could be conducted was really in person.
Yeah.
So,
and many of the stories I have seen over the years are not necessarily folks that lived or worked in New York. They were there for business meetings. They stayed at the Marriott Hotel that was there on the World Trade Center and were going to, you know, meetings and from folks from all over the country, because there were a lot of big institutions there. I mean, one of the big ones a lot of us probably have heard about was Morgan Stanley was housed there. I can't remember how many floors they had, but I know they had about 2,700 employees there. Part of the reason I know that is because of the heroism of Rick Rescorla. I won't get too far into it, but if you haven't looked up Rick, go online and Google him. A fascinating gentleman. He was a Vietnam War hero, and he was the head of security for Morgan Stanley. And funny story, right? We talk a lot about repetition and staying the course in finance. Well, for him, it was the same way with security. And he forced the company once a quarter to have an evacuation drill of those towers. And a lot of folks grumbled about it. Even the top execs tried to maneuver the way around it. But he was insistent that, no, once a quarter, we're going to practice how do you get out of this building in an emergency. And to this day, most of them credit him for having stayed that course, another repetition, where I don't know if all or at least the majority, I know he's credited with saving, you know, over 2,700 people, got out of that building. But even once he got his entire company out, got to the bottom, he went back up because now he wanted to sweep the floors and make sure that there was no one left behind. And sadly, he was still in the building when it came down. But he's also famous, if anyone's ever read the book We Were Soldiers Once and Young, great book about the Iadrang Valley battle there in Vietnam. But he is actually the soldier pictured on the cover of that book. So that's so interesting full circle life. He was serving other folks down to the very end. But
was his character in the movie We Were Soldiers? It's been a long
time since I've seen that. I imagine it was, but I'm not 100% certain. I couldn't tell you who played him.
Yeah. I couldn't tell you either. I know Mel Gibson was in that film. But
he was one of the – he played the main character there, Lieutenant Colonel Moore at the time, but three-star General Moore there. But, yeah, I mean, just amazing piece, right? I mean, so we're talking about all those different companies there. It had over 10 million square foot of office space, just a gigantic building. And don't forget, for some – I think it's easy to overshadow. It had tried to be bombed before that. Back in 93, someone drove a truck bomb in the bottom of it and tried to blow it up. Mm-hmm. Luckily, they were unsuccessful. A few folks did pass away, sadly. But yeah.
It's been a long time plot
from
those Al-Qaeda guys.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a long story, too, but unfortunate. But I think, you know, there was a lot of tragedy that day. I don't like to dwell on it, but it just is a fact. You know, 2,996 people were killed that day, which includes the 19 terrorists on the four different planes. But that included citizens of 78 countries who died between New York, Washington, D.C., and Pennsylvania. So, again, not just a U.S. event, but really a world event. And within that, I think, you know, we'd be remiss if we didn't mention the heroism of all those that were responding, you know. According to stats I have here, 343 firefighters and paramedics passed away, 23 New York police officers and 37 Port Authority police officers died trying to help folks in that building. So what a great courage we saw there. So it tragic day, as we know. From an economic impact, though, I think we have the stats, don't we, guys, of a lot of the impacts, both immediate and short term, of what happened when that building went down.
Yeah, so it's hard to estimate the exact economic impact because, you know, we're in the middle of recession already. But Homeland Security does actually of all people, has an interesting study on the internet that estimated that the 9/11 attacks themselves, excluding the decline from the dot-com bubble, caused a reduction of real GDP by 0.5% and an increase of unemployment by 0.11%, which doesn't seem like a lot, but when you're talking about trillions of dollars, 0.5% is a big number.
And from one single event.
One event.
It's crazy. And when we look at the impact directly from the World Trade Center, I believe this is from directly, but it said that in New York City's economy, 143,000 jobs were lost within a month. I'm sure a lot of that is, you know, the companies that either collapsed or jobs that just went away. Because remember, it's not just someone sitting at a desk, everyone that supports those areas that I'm sure were impacted. which equated to $2.8 billion worth of wages in the first 3 months. So that's a lot of money that's suddenly not moving in the economy in New York. And I think it's no surprise that the heaviest losses were taken inside the finance and the air transportation sectors, as I said, which accounts for about 60% of those jobs.
Yep.
And then the damage, just the estimated cost of the damage from the World Trade Center was an estimated $60 billion, with another $750 million costing for the cleanup.
Right.
So that's a lot of big numbers there.
Yep.
A lot of big numbers.
Yeah, and it's important too, because I, you know, someone that was not familiar with the World Trade Center before all of this, it is important, kind of like we mentioned earlier, that the World Trade Center was not just the two towers. It was the center itself was seven buildings. It was just the north and the south tower, right? Those were the two names.
Yeah, the main two towers.
The two that we know, but there's, you know, it was a seven building area. So when we say, you know, the damage was $60 billion. That's not just the two towers that collapsed. That's also the damage done to the entire
Oh, yeah, and everything they hit on itself. The way, and it destroyed.
Yep.
And I think even, I think it was Building 7, I believe, was one that stood for a while afterwards and finally eventually collapsed, you know, days, weeks later. I'm not sure exactly, but yeah, that's crazy. And then another financial impact that was interesting that I was reading about was insurance claims. Mm-hmm. So they estimated there were $40 billion, right? Insurance claims were an estimated $40 billion. And as part of that, the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act was passed, which basically decided to share those losses between the government and the insurance industry itself for terrorism, right? Trying to keep the insurance industry from collapsing, I'm sure, as a result of that.
Yeah, because I was reading that insurance companies were saying they'd have to increase the premiums to unpayable levels in order to be able to account for, you know, terrorism risk. And the government stepped in and said, in order to keep these premiums affordable for people, sure, we'll share losses, which is where that act comes from, if there is an act of terrorism, in order to keep that insurance industry afloat, because otherwise it would have come down, and at least in the way we know it now.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't even imagine how actuarially you could account for that type of risk, and I imagine the snowball that comes from it too, right? There's only so far you could really roll. But now, some things that did come out on 9/11 though that I thought was important to mention. One big one is the creation of the the Department of Homeland Security. Mm-hmm. That was created in 2002 in November, signed into law, and that was really due primarily from 9/11, but also shortly after we had a lot of the anthrax scares that some of you may remember. And both of those kind of combined were the big pushing forces into creating the Department of Homeland Security. And now, I mean, I imagine it's hard for many to remember when that department didn't exist. But that had a big impact across the board, I believe.
Not only that, I believe the presidential branch of the government had to, you know, create a new chairman to help force the coordination between the different intelligence agencies, who at the time were not coordinating, right?
Oh, yeah. There FBI were a lot of lessons learned.
Yeah.
Yeah. I won't get too far into it, but a couple things that came out of it. Of course, there are a lot of stories about where, you know, for example, CIA and FBI weren't talking to each other. Now, part of that was on purpose, though. I think it's important to keep in mind that the CIA's role is intelligence for the government and, you know, to pass to the military. Whereas the FBI's job really is to investigate and formulate cases that can be prosecuted in a criminal court in the U.S. So as you can imagine, how you gather what information you have or don't have, and, you know, the burdens of evidence, if you were, are quite different in those two different realms. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of reasons in the past why, for example, the CIA wouldn't pass information to the FBI, because it could taint a case, let's say, that now we couldn't. I think some of the priorities did shift because of that, though.
Right.
There was less concern maybe of building a case and prosecuting versus stopping
getting things done.
Yeah. And the powers of the presidency, I know, changed, and there was a lot of debate on that. The other thing that I remember reading that was interesting to me that came out of this, and again, I think it's in any tragedy, and I think I've applied this many times in my life, and I'm sure many listeners will, you know, anytime something doesn't go well, it's important to learn and improve off of that. You know, there were a lot of lessons learned. One of the things I read about that I didn't think was the difference between NORAD and the FAA. Right, the FAA is the civilian, basically, organization that controls airspace, radar, et cetera, whereas NORAD is the military version. NORAD was really focused on external threats, something flying into the U.S., missiles, planes, whatever, that's not supposed to be there, whereas the FAA was controlling the civilian air traffic. So when they were having these issues, NORAD and the FAA over the years had actually developed different terminology. So the two different organizations really couldn't talk to each other. Hmm. So when they were trying to say, hey, and I don't remember the exact, but for example, FAA, let's say, calls NORAD and says, hey, can you scramble some fighters for us? Well, the NORAD operator on the other side can't comprehend what the term scramble means. What are they really asking for? What does that mean? You know, we all from movies kind of guesstimate what it means, but when you're talking over the radio, it's very important that you're very clear, concise, and have exact, you know, can communicate exactly to the point what you want. Yeah. So,
well, and y'all could tell me, you know, inform me better than I know, but wasn't the TSA kind of birthed out of this as well to some extent because of the way security checkpoints and all that worked in the airports?
So the one example I have is, you know, watching Home Alone. You know, when they're racing to get to the airport, you know, they're 30 minutes from taking off and they're already, you know, they're still stuck at home in Chicago. Yeah. I can't imagine trying to get through Chicago O'Hare with security, but none of those things existed.
I've never thought about that with the movie. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. None of that existed back then.
You could pretty much just run straight through the airport and get to your gate. Is that kind of how that?
You check in, you get your ticket, you drop your bags off, and then
you go.
You go.
Yeah, there were still secure. There's still, you know, metal detectors, like that, but the rules about what you could and could not have and very things different. Like that were very loose. I mean, the terrorists were able to bring on utility knives, like X-Acto knives, like razor blades, basically, and that was perfectly allowed. Yeah, that's really changed a lot with Department of Homeland Security. I mean, that's you know, when you had the shoe bomber, that's why your shoes get inspected now. Yep. Someone, they uncovered a plot where people were trying to. Basically build a bomb on the plane using liquids. That's why you're limited at what size liquids you can bring, because they know, you know, how much of different liquids it takes to create an explosion, things like that. It's, it is fascinating. And although it's quite annoying and it's a shame that we have to go through that. Yeah. A lot of the lessons I think from 9/11 and thereon either were discovered or were already discovered. And we decided, hey, we probably should, you know, crank this up a bit.
Right.
So, yeah,
it's interesting, you know, looking at the way that air travel was impacted, you know, and I'm not sure who pulled this statistics on our little agenda page, but, you know, air passenger volume didn't hit the pre-9/11 high until July 2005. So,
wow.
4 years later.
Big impact there.
Yeah.
Big impact. And then who knew that COVID would strike?
Yeah.
You know? But 18 years later, if I'm doing my math fast enough, 19, right. Something like that. And
airlines
shut down yet again for a little while there.
They can't catch a break.
Nope.
And kind of along those lines, you know, General Electric, I found this interesting. They, at the time, they were basically like Apple, right? They were the pinnacle of the S&P 500. You know, the highest level of technology with products going all over the world, and you know, one of their big business lines was jet engines, right? So if you can't get jet engines to the airlines, then that's a big problem. And so going back to September 17th when the market was opened, General Electric lost 23% within one day. If you can imagine Apple losing 23% in one day, that's a big impact.
Wow.
All of that's kind of detailed in Jeff Immelt's book, Hot Seat. He's the former CEO of GE during the time of 9/11. He has a long chapter about the struggles during that time, you know, trying to communicate with the president and with the airlines and all this other stuff, and trying to, you know, work through a major crisis at this company. And General Electric, and this was not as a result of 9/11, but they never recovered their stock price.
Oh yeah.
So they were, you know, a lot of that has to do with mismanagement as opposed to
just
9/11. But 9/11 was like the spark that really sent them down.
Yeah. So certainly. Well, and I mean, it's hard to imagine companies did lose large percentages of their workforce. There were a lot of insurance, financial institutions, et cetera, in there, a lot of industry, you know, trade. And I can only imagine even the companies that are still around today, it had to take them some time to recover from that situation. Yeah, devastating.
Yeah, and one other thing, I think, Brian, I think you pulled this, but for those of you that have seen the show Billions, Bobby Axelrod, who's the manager of Axe Capital, you know, was outside the World Trade Center when 9/11 happened within the show. And you know, his partners passed away and all that, and he kind of took the firm and then grew it from there. That bears a lot of similarity to Cantor Fitzgerald, their CEO Howard Lutnick. He was actually taking his son to school and dropping him off when the 9/11 attacks happened, while the rest of his fund was in one of the buildings collapsed, and Lutnick carried on the company itself, but they lost 658 of their 960 employees.
My goodness. Yeah.
During that. So that's, you know, kind of a interesting story that we've seen played out, you know, as a story in a TV show that actually, you know, was kind of a reality for some people.
Yeah. That character, Bobby Axelrod, was based off of partially, you know, that backstory is based off of the Cantor Fitzgerald CEO. His main character, like, trajectory is really Steve Cohen, the current owner in New York Mets. But it's you know, kind of puts into perspective specifically the fact that they lost 658, you know, 2/3 of their workforce. You know, how do you recover from that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. Well, there were a lot of tragedies that day, that's for sure, folks. I think on a positive note, a lot has happened since then. We have been through several ups and downs in the economy, right? That was a dot-com bubble era. Of course, we still went through the great financial crisis, 08, went through COVID. But at the same time, here we all are. We're still here. America's, the market's still open today, as far as I know, Brian, right?
It is still open today.
Yeah, so.
The resilience of the American people.
Yeah, I think it's a true testament to what we can do. What we can do. So never forget your scars, folks. That's what you learn from. And I've kind of enjoyed actually going down memory lane a little bit and being nostalgic about it. So tough day, though. Our hearts go out to all those that lost their lives and were affected by this, as well as afterwards as well. I mean, a lot of folks answered the call to duty with first responders going to help, with military members taking up arms to protect our country and continue to do so to this day. So appreciate y'all joining me today to discuss this. Hopefully those of you listening enjoyed a little bit of recap from our thoughts. If you got any other questions about us, about our firm, who we serve, what we do, please feel free to reach out to us. Easiest way to do that is go to our website at www.signaturewmg.com. You can access the Contact Us page to communicate with us. And yeah, let us know what you think about the podcast and maybe even share a little bit of your story about 9/11 as well. Until next time, folks, thanks for joining. From all of us here at Signature Wealth Management Group, thank you for listening to the Up and to the Right podcast presented by SWMG. We hope you enjoyed the show, and we welcome you to continue to tune in as we release new episodes. In the meantime, you can stay up to date with relevant financial news by connecting with us on LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are Signature Wealth Management Group on LinkedIn and Facebook, at Signature WMG on Twitter, and at Signature Wealth on Instagram. You can also visit our blog on our website at www.signaturewmg.com/blog. We look forward to your continued support and engagement.
The information in this podcast is educational and general in nature and does not take into consideration the listener's personal circumstances. Therefore, it is not intended to be a substitute for specific, individualized financial, legal, or tax advice. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professional prior to making a final decision. We suggest you discuss your specific tax situation with a qualified tax advisor. Investment advice offered through Signature Wealth Management, a registered investment advisor. Signature Wealth only transacts business in states where it is properly registered or is excluded or exempted from registration requirements. Information presented or believed to be factual and up to date, but we do not guarantee its accuracy and its publication and are subject to change. Information should not be regarded as a complete analysis of the subjects discussed. All outside guests of Up and to the Right podcast are not affiliated with Signature Wealth Management Group, and their opinions are their own and do not reflect the views of Signature Wealth Management Group. Past performance is not indicative of future results.